Hey listeners, Shrill Collective here. Just a heads up that The Rat King contains adult content, including descriptions and instances of stalking and violence. Listener discretion is advised. Resources for these issues can be found in the show notes and at the end of the episode. Please enjoy The Rat King. Welcome, everybody. This is The Rat King, Part 5. Open this episode talking a little bit about deals. I'm not sure how I feel about them myself. They always seem a little icky. Deals are pretty much human compulsion. We employ them constantly, from handshakes to legislating. A compromise is a kind of deal. Admirable sometimes, diminishing at others. We make deals when we get married or take a job. The United States is founded on the premise of the deal, even though the details of these early agreements are generally dubious at best. Take the Dutch acquisition of Manhattan, the alleged purchase from the Lenape people. This is an infamous arrangement, with no definitive record, no paper trail. Dig into this deal, just the minimum, and it pretty much stinks. The entire territory of Manhattan, the hilly island, for some trinkets and a few guilders. By all accounts, it was a pretty opaque understanding, especially considering the two parties share no common tongue. This was certainly a land grab rather than a cogent trade, not to mention a total perversion of good faith, the implications of which continue to stain the region and the very soul of this nation to this day. So it begins, and so it continues. Deals are everywhere, and the terms of deals are frequently up for dispute. One party will have a certain impression of a supposed agreement, and another party will often have a very different idea. Contracts help. Some. Meaning they help some, but not others. Even the ability to afford and create a sustainable contract is privileged territory. It can require resources and experience, or else the contract can end up being more an abuse than a protection. Yet, deal-making is foundational to our social power structures and our fundamental psychology. Though, let's be honest, a complicated and tenuous foundation at best. About as stable as the shifting, gravelly underpinnings to the front pavers of the Adelphi Street brownstone. As I've listened to Daphne recount her Phoebus saga, I've noticed a lot of unusual deals taking place. And what I've really noticed about these deals in particular is how nebulous and unreliable they tend to be. You'll remember Jade and Gary have an unofficial deal that he'll manage the Adelphi house. And Jade makes another deal with Gary when he moves out, that he'll live rent-free in the Halsey apartment. And Daphne makes a deal with Jade to paint. And she too becomes a less enthusiastic, but still, kind of property manager when it comes to the trash area, at least. So yeah, not great. The basic structure of good deal making has really eluded the people in Daphne's story. Even where Phoebus is concerned. Whatever happened to the common presupposition that if you are dating someone, they are also dating you. Or if someone stops dating you, say 23 years ago, you will stop dating them. I think we can probably add a big footnote here about consent. Up to this point, a lot of the deals going on around Daphne are, let's face it, pretty Swiss cheesy. And the reason I'm bringing all of this up is because Daphne herself is on the verge of entering into yet another kind of deal. A really, really unreliable sort. Without contracts, or any kind of real objectivity. So, let's do this. Part 5. Let's make a deal.
I went around the nest. And there it was. And I will never, ever forget it.
What is it?
The Rat King.
If you're like me, you're now imagining the giant mouse king from the Nutcracker that assaulted your dreams as a child. Or maybe a gregarious Falstaff type who lives beneath the city, happy and harmonious with his rodent brethren. Neither. Maybe you're already familiar with the term. I wasn't. I searched it online. And believe me when I say, if you decide to go down that road, the Rat King is something you cannot unsee. If you're super squeamish or have a phobia, I suggest you don't go searching images. So who or what is this Rat King?
So it wasn't just one singular creature. It was about 20 or so rats all tangled together, like a wheel of rats with their tails attached in the center. They were rolling and flipping over each other. I guess they were especially active because they were feasting.
I don't want to ask, but...
Yeah, on the squirrel. It was pretty macabre. A few of them were dead.
Wait, the rats were?
Yeah, at least three. At least three were dead. But they were still tied together with the others, getting tossed around in the fray.
Okay, so envision 20-some-odd rats, several of these dead and in different stages of decomposition, connected at the tail, the live ones ravenously devouring the little squirrel, and in the process, exacerbating the already impossible knot that ensnares them. And I know, this seems totally freaky, not to mention unlikely, but apparently Daphne's Rat King isn't even a one-off. This phenomenon has been documented since the mid-16th century. Some specimens are even preserved in museums. The Mauritianum in Altenburg, Germany, has an offering 32 rats strong. I didn't know this.
Why would you? Why would anyone?
So, can you explain to us what exactly is going on here?
As far as I can tell, there isn't any definitive explanation. The most common theory I found is that the rats' tails initially get fixed together by some kind of natural secretion or by something external, like sap or maybe resin.
How? When?
I'm not sure, but probably in their sleep. And then once they wake up and start to move around, they get twisted together.
And the more they struggle, the more entangled they become.
Exactly. There's another theory that some rat kings might have been constructed by actual people, you know, as some sort of street show attraction. If that's the case, their tails were probably fixed together by a kind of glue.
I'd like to say it's hard to imagine that being an appealing show.
Knowing people, I guess it isn't that hard for me to imagine.
So, what do you think when you see this Rat King?
Honestly, I was mesmerized by it. By the... How can I describe it? It was almost familiar.
In what way was it familiar?
Sometimes it takes reflection to conjure metaphor. But in this case, it just happened in real time. I mean, I felt like I was the Rat King. All of my joys and pleasures were tied into this one tortured knot with Phoebus and the infestations at the center. And if I kept trying to free myself from it, it would only get worse. I guess that's why I wasn't afraid being down there. I was moving toward a kind of clarity.
Daphne says at this point, staring at this monstrous 20-headed rigmarole of rats, she's reminded of that less than satisfying call she'd had with her angel guide a few months back.
Less than satisfying at the time. I don't think I was in the mind frame yet to understand what she was communicating to me. But looking at the Rat King, I think it finally clicked. The whole predicament, my embroilment with Phoebus and the rats, it wasn't going to be solved by hiring a lawyer or filing a complaint or getting a restraining order. It had to be dealt with on a cosmic level. Because he and I and the rats, we were all on the same radio channel. And it wasn't a healthy one.
It's probably a good time to find out a little more about Daphne's angel guide. It is the one detail that's really been pestering me. Maybe because it's the first time Daphne and I have stumbled into a territory where we really just fundamentally diverge in our approach. And just a gentle reminder as we move into this next interview, this podcast is an examination of Daphne's experience around stalking and infestation, not a prescription for anyone else's. It turns out, Daphne has been doing these angel guide readings since the early 2000s, when she lived in Los Angeles. She was having a rough transition from the East Coast, felt a little lost out there. So Daphne's friend, a tarot card reader at a local spiritist center, suggests she talk to a colleague named...
Greta D.
Thanks for talking. So I think a lot of listeners might be unfamiliar with your practice. Can you give a brief rundown of what you do?
I'm an angel communicator and portrait artist, currently out of Santa Barbara, California.
And when you say angel communicator and portrait artist?
A liaison to the spirit realm. Angels and guides speak to me and I relate their messages to my clients. I'm also a trained visual artist, yes? So I compose my impressions of the guardian angels as I converse with them.
This immediately seems like a grift to me. And basically like a very elevated version of a boardwalk caricaturist. But I try to keep my skepticism at bay.
What if someone doesn't have a guardian angel?
Everyone has one.
Do I have one?
Of course you do. And you have many, many guides and angels around you. Imagine you are in the middle of a great stadium and the seats are filled with encouraging, vibrantly positive spectators, and they are cheering for you, imbuing you with love and purpose.
I do like the sound of that. Love and purpose might just be the key to human existence. And do you hear the way she sings her words? How delicious and melty she sounds?
Have you ever thought about what messages your angels might have for you?
I'm not sure I want to know. Is it ever bad news?
There isn't any negativity in the divine realm. A lot of the negativity that drives human beings is corporeal, of the body. We often make the mistake of letting our bodies dictate our paths. Our angels are here to help us correct course.
Can you explain that?
I'm getting a sense from you that you might enjoy a scientific explanation.
I do like science.
Do you know what cortisol is?
The stress hormone?
So what happens when you feel fear? Cortisol increases the glucose levels in your bloodstream, which ignites that fight or flight instinct.
Okay.
Now, in a society such as ours, where we are pummeled by the 24-hour news cycle, money woes, social anxieties, what do you think is happening to us? Living in that perpetual enhanced state of stress and fear, as most Americans at least do.
You're saying the result is our cortisol levels are continuously triggered.
And our fears and stresses are flowing unchecked through our veins. So this is what I mean when I say human beings let our bodies dictate our life paths. Stress and fear are functions of our physiology, and we answer to them.
I think I understand what you're suggesting. Basically, angels aren't part of our physiology, so they don't deal in stress and fear.
They know no fear. Their joy is reflecting our soul path back onto us.
To be perfectly honest, I had not expected to find a lot of common ground with Greta, though I do take away some valuable nuggets. And I do find myself wanting to climb through the phone and take a nap in her lap. But it's important to note, while Greta's insights are very welcome to this conversation, and rather fascinating in their own right, she does not claim to be a psychologist or a professional on the subject of stalking. I would urge our listeners experiencing any kind of stalking or harassment to seek guidance from a professional or helpline. Resources, as always, listed at the end of this episode.
So when Daphne brings up her stalker dilemma, what do you tell her?
The message I communicated to Daphne is that her commitment must be to raise her own vibration, not his.
That's it?
Essentially, yes. That's what her angels wanted her to know. She could manifest a higher path.
And this makes sense to you now?
Yes. It wasn't about blaming myself or absolving Phoebus in any way. Phoebus has agency, I think we can all agree on that. But if nothing else, I could control this one piece. My energy, my vibration.
So what do you do?
I made a deal.
With who?
With myself.
A deal with herself. Sounds simple enough. But if we've learned anything, Daphne's situation isn't simple, and neither are its remedies. Between friends, family, attorneys, law enforcement, and divine guides, there just hasn't seemed to be a single deft way of ending the saga. Maybe it will take all of these things together. Or maybe it will take something else entirely.
So, what does a deal between you and yourself look like?
I committed to leave the Adelphi apartment, along with the psychic black hole I'd conjured there. I committed to be conscious of my thoughts and fluid with my feelings, to be grateful, to be forgiving. I said these things out loud, I'm not kidding. Crazy as it sounds. I knelt on the ground a few feet from the rat's nest where I could see the mother rat, where I could look in her eyes, and I said it all out loud.
Is that all you say?
And I gave them the Adelphi house. I said goodbye.
Daphne recalls that in that moment, she finally sees the rats not as co-conspirators in the Phoebus problem, but as a relatively innocent party, drawn to the frenzied energy that was simultaneously consuming her. She needs to shift, and quickly, and radically. So when Daphne climbs out of the underground tunnels beneath the Adelphi house, she decides to leave Phoebus behind with the rats. She leaves the idea of him as a person of influence behind. And she also leaves his shredded letters. She does carefully extract the strands of her fire engine red hair, whirled up at the edge of the nest. Surprisingly, the mother rat lets her do this and only observes Daphne with a mild ambivalence.
I went through the apartment collecting all of Phoebus's remaining letters. I tore them up and dropped them into the trapdoor under the stairs. And I hired someone to relay the pavers in front. I had to pick up 3 extra shifts to pay for that.
When Kay finally returns from Atlanta, Daphne tells them she's reached a resolution about the Phoebus situation, and she wants to move ASAP.
What do you think about that?
I wasn't thrilled about leaving that apartment, but to be fair, neither was Dee. We loved that place, but in the big scheme, it didn't matter. Her safety mattered, and our sanity, obviously.
I'm curious, how does she explain her sudden shift to you?
What do you mean? She said she had taken care of the Phoebus thing and wanted a fresh start.
Taken care of it how?
You know, made it clear he can't contact her anymore.
But does she say how she does that?
I'm assuming it was some kind of cease and desist. That's what the attorney, Nibby, said to do.
So, maybe you're getting the impression Kay has a relaxed understanding of Daphne's approach here. And Daphne isn't exactly straightforward about her epiphany under the brownstone. Fast forward again to Kay, August 2020, passing Daphne the letter that marks Phoebus' revival. I thought you made a deal.
I never lied. I told Kay I'd figured it out and Phoebus wouldn't bother me anymore. And I said it was really important to me that we move, start fresh, whatever.
They think you sent him a cease and desist.
They made an assumption, I guess. Look, if they were interested in the details, they'd know the details. It is what it is.
Okay, I'm not touching that one with a 10-foot pole. Of course, miraculously, Jade reappears just in time to absolutely lather Daphne and Kay in guilt for moving on such short notice.
But it wasn't short notice. We gave her a full month's notice.
So you start the process of moving.
Yeah. Jade sent a few prospective renters and I walked them through the space, pointing out this and that, just like Gary did for me. They asked how the landlady was, and I said the same strange stuff as Gary. She's great. It's great. We've been here forever. We wouldn't be leaving if it wasn't for whatever blah 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 opportunity. And it was all true. And false. And totally necessary.
And the place gets rented?
Oh, yeah. It got snatched up right away. And Jade increased the rent by another $1,000 a month. Oh, and the trash cans are not replaced.
Do you do what you say you'll do?
Yes. When we left the Adelphi House, I really didn't look back. By August 2013, Kay and I were living just about a mile east of Fort Greene by that massive Home Depot.
Oh, yeah, I know that one. On Nostrand?
Yeah, yeah. But our block is quiet and very beautiful, with trees all up and down the street.
And as I mentioned in the first episode of this saga, Daphne again finds herself inhabiting the ground floor apartment, this time belonging to a much smaller, two-unit brownstone.
And so, is this your thing? Do you always look for ground floor apartments?
No, I always look for garden apartments.
Even after that experience?
Evidently.
What do you think that means about you?
I don't know. Maybe I prefer moss and melancholy to, whatever, sunshine and happiness?
That's not quite true. But it could be. It's close.
So how is it?
We really loved it. It's an old, charming house. But it had just been newly appointed, so it was the best of both worlds. Nothing needed to be rigged or propped.
No gaps.
As far as we could tell, there were no gaps. We had a finished basement in the unit, so we had more interior space to play around with. The backyard was completely empty, just a 40 by 20 expanse of dirt. So we planted forsythia, night jasmine, wisteria, basil, cilantro, rosemary, mint, hydrangeas.
And those things grow and thrive. Everything is fresh energy. There's no carryover. More shows and movies are filming locally at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. And Kay gets to work nearby. They decide to have a child.
How is being pregnant?
Like, do I recommend it?
Not even asking for a friend.
For me, it was really great. I I think it was one of the first times I've just inhabited the present tense, which was a very freeing place to be. I'm usually like a past-future combo.
What's that look like?
Like rotating nostalgia and anxiety.
Sounds...
Yeah. Yeah.
They have another child 3 years later. And day-to-day life turns into that crazy inertia you hear parents describe. And for a long time, several years, in fact, Daphne makes good on her deal. But I can't shake one pestering thought. This is it. Daphne has staked her life on the most unpredictable kind of deal a person can make. The kind that draws from your most protected resources, most sacred, and most vulnerable. A deal you make with yourself. And in spite of their powerful potential, we break these deals freely and often without thought. It is a great human flaw that we are least accountable to ourselves. And the fallout from breaking a deal with yourself, though often untraceable, can be far more corrosive than any mere contract dispute. This is Daphne's deal. And maybe, just maybe, it might work out.
I felt like I'd really closed the chapter on Phoebus. I didn't do so much as Google his name. And the new apartment didn't have a single mouse, rat, or other.
By the year 2020, the little boys are 6 and 3. Daphne is just going into workshops for a play she's written. And then... the pandemic just pummels New York. Being service and film industry people, Daphne and Kay both lose their jobs immediately. School closes. Everything is thrown into uncertainty. Those listeners who live in New York will remember the morning-to-night ambulances, the refrigerated morgue trucks, the field hospitals, the graveyard of shuttered businesses.
We were lucky. We didn't lose anyone or get sick. Kay and I both managed to get unemployment benefits. Our landlord suspended rent for a few months, and the kids had a backyard, which really helped all of us cope.
Of course, the story playing out around Daphne is not so lucky. And for the first time in a long time, people stop and watch and listen with rapt attention. Deals start falling apart all over the place.
I can't pay rent. Nope.
We were supposed to get married in June. Maybe it's a blessing. 2 months of quarantine and we just realized we couldn't stand to be around each other.
I couldn't afford my employees. I've had some of these guys for 12, 15 years. I don't know. What do I do? It kills me.
Yeah, I started using again.
I told my dad I would visit him every week. I didn't see him in person for 5 months.
People just started dropping trash everywhere. Like, nothing matters. It's like the 1980s.
I'm standing at the window looking at my baby, and she's not a baby anymore. And I'm telling her, you can't come inside. Mama cannot give you a hug right now.
There are other deals, too. Some founding principles that sustain a lot of people's faith. Preserve the sanctity of life. Protect and serve. Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution. But these same agreements have always been conditional, whether you realize it or not. Whose life? Protect who? Serve who? What does a deal really mean? Or have they ever meant anything at all? The Rat King is a production of The Shrill Collective. It was written by L.R. Wilde, directed by Chelsea Feltman and Ash Croce. Audio engineering and sound design by Brando Kress. Production assistance by Christina Cole, Allison Wilkes-Borland, and Linda DeFuria. Cover art by Samantha Ferrello. Featuring the voices of Stephanie Lavadera, Kelly Grego, Daniel Van Thomas, Fernando Vieira, Karen Levan, Richard Fisher, Dina Laura, Cherie Wishard, Al Pagano, and Rachel Feltman. The music was written, recorded, and arranged by Chelsea Feltman, Brando Kress, and Tim Leonard. Special thanks to Tim Leonard, Wes Borland, Max Zimbert, Monique Morgan, Laura Annister Walters, Maureen and Robert Croce, Rachel Feltman, Tessa Fay, and Tay Birch. If you or someone you know is being stalked, or as a survivor of domestic or sexual abuse, help is available. Go to stalkingawareness.com for victim resources and information. This and other information is linked in the show notes.